I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors. Today on The Prosecutors, we continue our investigation into the murders of Abigail Williams and Liberty German. Help us find the Delphi Killer. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. I'm Brett, and I'm joined, as always, with my intrepid co-host, Alice.
Oh, thank you, Brett.
Yeah, Alice never gives up. You know, when Alice is on the case, it's going to be solved one way or the other. So,
well,
there you go.
I think that's funny because right before this, I was just complaining to Brett about work. So I feel like I put myself in the worst light because I'm coming to you at the end of a busy work day. Most times we're recording. And then you have to think of something nice to say about me.
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely one of those days coming to you at the end of a long work day. I think we both are in that shape. And let me just say, we love our jobs. I know we complain about them a lot, particularly in the outtakes. But we actually do really like our jobs. Right, Alice? We like our jobs.
I love my job. I really do. But it does take everything out of you, I think.
Some days take everything out of you. And it helps to complain about it. So thank you guys for listening to us complain incessantly about our very wonderful jobs that we are very happy to have. So
it pays the bills, unlike this.
It does pay the bills. Unlike this podcast.
But thank you to our Patreon patrons.
Yes, exactly. Thank you to our patrons. Thank you to our patrons who recommended we cover this case. As I said on the last episode, this was one that I was really hesitant to cover for all the reasons that are obvious because I'm a wimp at the end of the day and didn't want to tackle this one. But I'm really glad that we did. It is an important case. I don't think there's any question about that. It's a case that needs to be solved. And hopefully somebody out there is going to be able to do that. We said this a lot in the last episode, that this is really on you guys. I hate to put all the pressure on you, but you know, I'm just hoping that out there is somebody who knows something, or you know, one of y'all is going to recommend our podcast to somebody, and they're going to listen to it, and they're going to know something. I think this is just one. This is one that needs to be solved. It needs to be solved, and it's going to be solved because of one of y'all. So glad to be back doing it, even if it is not necessarily the This will never be our favorite case to cover. I'll say that.
I think it will be the one that sticks with me the most. I was telling Brett before we started recording that sometimes I like to be surprised with the audience because we record these ahead of time, and I try not to listen to them until it's released so I can kind of be surprised with everyone else. And I forget what I say sometimes in the intervening time. But this is one of those cases where every detail really does stick with me, and I really do think about it often, you know, before bed and when I'm going on a hike. I really do think about this case a lot. So, and I know that's the same for a lot of you out there.
Yeah, it's easy to become obsessed with this case. It's easy to sort of run through everything we know over and over and over and over again and think about those details and think about the little things and how those little things might tell a bigger story. Hopefully, what we've been doing has done that for you guys. Hopefully you're thinking of it in the same way. And like I said, if there's anybody from Delphi or that area, hopefully you're thinking through any experiences you might have had on those trails and whether any of those experiences might be relevant to this. At the end of last week's episode, we ended with the murder, which as you'll recall, was around 2:30, 2:45 is the best guess that people have based on a few different things. That's when we think this happened. So a little over an hour after the girls were dropped off, less than an hour before they were supposed to be picked up. I mean, this is the timing on this thing is tight. And, you know, the more we talk about this case, the more we talk about theories, all those little things are going to become important. And I think that becomes important. The fact that there just wasn't a lot of time here. This wasn't the girls were out, you know, on a week-long hike or something where there was a lot of time for somebody to formulate a plan and decide what they were going to do. This is a tight timeline. And we'll talk more about that and how important that might be later.
Brett, I'll go ahead and just kind of preview my hand a little bit, but I think because of such a tight timeline, this was likely a crime of opportunity with regards to the girls. I know this is going to be controversial to say this early on, but what I mean to say is the girls, I don't think knew exactly when they were going to be dropped off. I don't think they knew exactly when they would be on that bridge. And I think because of how quick this timeline worked, they were really in the wrong place at the wrong time and were targeted simply for being there for the killer.
No, I think that's interesting. And yeah, it probably will be controversial to a certain extent. We're going to talk about it more and why we think that's probably true. As we move towards our theories in this case, there are people who think that, you know, groomed is a strong word in this instance, but maybe someone who they were talking to online or maybe knew casually could have set this up, like, hey, meet me at the trails, knew they were going to be there, and then committed this crime. But there are reasons to think that's possible, and there are reasons to think it's not. I do think it's an interesting question, and I think it's one that should be looked at and should be looked at seriously by the police, but I think there's definitely some things that cut against that. So look forward to talking about that either a little bit later in this episode or in the next episode we do on this case. But for now, let's return to the timeline. So we are at around 2:45 p.m. on February 13th, 2017. A woman named Cheyenne Ingalls arrives where the girls have been dropped off. This is another thing that hasn't been confirmed, but I think Miss Ingalls has confirmed it and has done a pretty good job confirming that she was there at the time. So even though I don't think the police have ever confirmed this, I think this is a pretty solid fact that we can talk about. So she arrives around 2:45 on the trails, and she has a similar idea to the girls. She's going to go to the Monon High Bridge. She basically follows their general path to the bridge, and it takes her about 15 minutes, just like it would have taken the girls about 15 minutes, to get from where she parks to the bridge. At around 3 p.m., she's on the other end of the bridge, the south end of the bridge, the dead end part of the bridge. And from there, she takes a picture from that end of the bridge. It's around 3 p.m. What's interesting, she reports that she hears nothing and she sees nothing. So this is 30 minutes, 15 minutes from when we think the girls were probably killed. Now, that's some speculation on that timeline, but you got to think where Ingalls is standing is not that far from where the girls' bodies will be found.
So, Brett, from where Ingalls is standing on the bridge, could she potentially see the bodies?
I don't know that she could see the bodies. I don't know that she could see the bodies from there because there are trees. The bodies, my understanding, are kind of down in a ditch, might be one way to describe it. Once again, I mean, we're going to talk about that some more too, but that's also speculation about it, where exactly the girls were found. But that's sort of what my understanding is of where the girls were found.
Can I ask one follow-up on that? I agree with you. I don't think she could have seen the bodies from there. From there, has anyone done sound tests? Could she have heard screams from where the bodies were located?
Now that, I think, is a very interesting question. I don't know that anyone's ever done scream test. We talked about this when we talked about the staircase, doing some tests to see what someone could hear in an area they likely were at the time an accident was happening or a crime was happening. I think it would be very interesting to do that. I mean, I'll just say this. Looking at the map, it's not perfectly to scale, obviously, but it does not seem like the girls are all that far, sort of as the crow flies, from that bridge. And I would think that if there were screams, if there were sounds of a struggle, that she might have heard something, even if it were sort of distant. I mean, sound carries. Sound carries, and, you know, there's water there. Sound carries well over the water. I think she would have heard something. I think if this murder were sort of ongoing when she was standing on that bridge. Now, we don't know, obviously. We don't know if the video reveals this or the sound caught on the video reveals this. We don't know what kind of struggle there was. You know, I think it's probably a safe bet that there was some noise that accompanied this attack, but we don't know that for sure. But if there were, and she were standing on that bridge when it happened, I've got to think she would have heard it. So for me, the fact that she's there and the fact that she's there at 3 o'clock really sort of cements for me that this crime is over by then. By that point, it's done.
Yeah, I agree with you, Brett, because, again, we haven't been there. We don't know whether you can hear things, but two things could happen. It's very quiet out there, so any sort of noise likely that's out of the ordinary, out of a bird chirping, out of a normal, you know, animal twig sort of disturbance will probably stand out. But second, if she is out there and the girls can hear or see her, it gives them an opportunity to scream for help. Even though that could be risky, at least someone will know they're down there. And from what we can tell, nothing of that happened. So I agree with you that I think the crime has already been completed by that point.
And that's a good point, Alice. You know, even if from your position on the bridge, you wouldn't necessarily be able to see anyone below you, that doesn't mean that someone down there wouldn't be able to see you. And that's an interesting point, that if the girls were still alive at that time and they can see the bridge and there's someone standing on the bridge, it certainly would be, I think it would be hard not to scream at that point. I mean, even if you were really scared, I think it would be hard not to see that person as a potential savior, because whatever was going through the girls' minds when they recorded the video, and we talked about some of the weird statements that the police have made and the fear on their faces and that kind of thing. Whatever was going on then, I mean, by the time he's ordered them down the hill and he's taking control of them, at that point, they know this is a really serious situation. I mean, we are in a nightmare.
You know, the type of person who takes the risk of filming someone, obviously at that point, I don't think they actually knew that he was going to do them serious harm. I think that they thought he was strange, but that is still a risk, because you're risking seriously pissing off someone who you already have serious concerns about. That is the same type of person, I think, who will scream out when there is a potential witness on a bridge. Even if it means, because at that point you're like, I'm going to die anyways. At least someone can find me and know, maybe catch this guy, because she already took out her camera. She was bold enough to do that. I do think that Libby would have at least screamed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, I think Bridge Guy thought he was going to get a couple docile teenage girls who were going to do whatever he said. And whatever ended up happening in this, I don't think he got what he expected. I think whether they attempted to flee him at some point or they fought back or whatever, you know, these girls, I think they did fight, and I think he was in for a surprise. And I think you're right. I think if they had seen an opportunity to try and get someone to help them, they would have taken it. And I think the fact, once again, that she didn't hear anything and she didn't see anything at 3 o'clock means this was probably over at 3 o'clock. We have another unconfirmed thing I want to talk about. Most of you know that there are two sketches that were eventually provided by the police. If you're watching this video, if you watched the last video, you've seen those sketches. You also know, and we're going to talk about this a good bit, that the sketches are very different. And the reason they're very different is because, and this is another thing we sort of have to infer, right? Because the police have told us so little. It seems pretty clear to me that these two sketches come from two different people, two different groups of people. We have talked about one unconfirmed witness that we've heard about, a 16-year-old girl who saw Bridge Guy near the Freedom Bridge. Now we're going to talk about another unconfirmed possible sighting of Bridge Guy that may very well have factored in to one of these sketches. It's 3:10, 3:15, around that time. Bridge Guy, or someone that we think is Bridge Guy, passes a 20-something male witness and his girlfriend, who's a little bit younger than him. He is heading west towards the Freedom Bridge. So he's heading away from the crime scene, away from the Monon High Bridge. He is described as wearing a hat that looked like a painter's cap or one with a short brim. I'm thinking like a newsies cap, something along those lines. According to this witness, he is wearing a scarf covering the lower part of his face. I want to go back to what the 16-year-old said she saw and just compare it to what I just described to you. She says, blue jeans, blue coat, and a hoodie pulled up over a short-billed hat. Also, some sort of covering over the lower half of his face. Those are pretty similar descriptions from these two different groups of people. We speculated that the thing that was covering the lower half of his face was actually the bottom of his hoodie. Well, this person says it wasn't the hoodie, it's a scarf that he's sort of wearing around the bottom of his face. Now, I just want to go back to the weather that day. There's no way this random dude is just wearing a scarf out there. I mean, I'm sorry. It's just not happening. Number one, it's not cold enough to be bundled up in a scarf. Number two, maybe this is sexist of me, but how many middle-aged guys wear scarves? I don't see that often. I do not own a scarf. Alice, do you own scarves?
I do own scarves. And you're right. It actually has to be pretty cold out before. You know, we've both lived in the Northeast. You do wear scarves, but it's usually when it is blustering outside. And the only time it's covering the lower part of my face is when it is literally blizzarding and I have to walk outside. So I remember walking to class in a blizzard, and that's the only time I've had a scarf up over my nose. Otherwise, all of us know, you know, we're wearing masks in the age of COVID. It's not that comfortable to have something covering your mouth. And so for it to be a warm day where people are in short sleeve shirts, to be wearing a scarf covering your mouth is out of place.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And even if you do wear a scarf, and I'm sorry if I insulted all the scarf wearing men out there, my apologies. But look, scarves are a hassle. You know, you got to carry them around and wrap them around yourself, and they're always falling off and all this other stuff. I'm not a scarf fan. And I think you're right. The only way you would do that, and look, this is not Dr. Blix or whatever her name is, the COVID lady, you know, who's like super put together and fashionable, and she's wearing a different scarf for every time she appears on camera. I mean, we're talking about a guy who does not exactly have the best fashion sense. So if he's wearing a scarf, it's for one of two reasons. Either because he's really, really cold, which doesn't fit with the temperature that day, or because he's trying to hide his face. And if you're trying to murder somebody, or if you go out there with the intention of murdering somebody, trying to hide your face is something you're probably going to want to do.
Which means, Brett, you're right. He went out there, wanted to be disguised, because he probably didn't find a scarf on his way out there. People probably didn't have scarves. So he went out there with a scarf, wanting to hide his face from the very beginning.
The more we talk about this, the more convinced I am. And we're not trying to convince you of anything.
We're just trying to work through this, because that is actually a new angle that I didn't see previously, especially when I just said that I think it's a crime of opportunity. But I hadn't quite thought through whether he went out there to kill that day. And the fact that he's wearing that scarf, you're right. As you're talking, I'm like, man, he did go out there to kill or do some harm.
That's what I think. I think there are two different sort of paths that you can take on this. The first one is that he went out there to kill Abby and Libby, that was the plan. The second one is he went out there with the intent of being prepared to kill someone if he got the opportunity. And I think if you look at what we have here, we have someone who is dramatically overdressed, who appears to be attempting to hide their identity. I think he went out there essentially with a kill kit within his clothes. I think he was trying to hide his identity, and his plan was, if I get the chance, I'm going to strike. That's what I see. You know, it's kind of like going out, you know, if you're going hunting for animals, not for people, and, you know, you go out and you wear all the right clothes and you're wearing orange and you have your gun and you set yourself up, and if a deer or a turkey or whatever happens to wander by, you go for it. You know, you try and kill that turkey, you try and kill that deer, and you didn't go out there that day thinking, you know, I want that turkey. It's just, you were prepared. You had the right equipment. You had the right clothes. You had the right plan, and it either comes together or it doesn't. There's plenty of times you might go hunting and you don't see a single thing, and then you go home that night. And this is why, and I just want to return to this, it is not just about February 13th. This person, in my view, went to those trails that day looking for someone to kill. It is almost certain that that was not the first time he did that. It is almost certain that he'd gone out there before looking for people. I just want to go back to something Cheryl McCollum said in our episode with her. And if you guys haven't listened to that, it's the best episode we've done. You should listen to it. And it's all because of her. It has nothing to do with us. She says in that episode, look at the place that the murder occurs or where the bodies are left. We have both of those here. Essentially, the murder occurs the same place as where the bodies are left. And the reason you look at that is because that was chosen by the murderer. The murderer picked that place for a reason. And it says something about them that they picked that place. And what do we have here? We have someone who murdered two young girls in broad daylight in a place that was fairly crowded. What that tells me is, despite those two facts, he felt very comfortable there. We have this bridge, a bridge that people have described is very difficult to cross. That tells me that he has crossed that bridge before. He knew the area. He knew what he was doing. He knew where he wanted those girls to go. There was no hesitation. He gets to the end of the bridge and he knows down the hill. That's where he wants them to go. Right? So in my view, this guy knew exactly what he was doing and he was ready to do it. And it probably wasn't the first time.
Yeah, Brett, I agree with you. I think this was planned out in the sense that he had probably fantasized about it and maybe walked different parts of the trail trying to find the perfect place to commit it, and recognizing that this was a rickety bridge that few would cross. And then once there, his victims couldn't run from him because of the dead-end nature of it and also the rickety, rotted planks that the bridge was made up of. And I agree with you. What we know about him based on the murder location, bold guy, not afraid of much, not afraid of authorities, apparently, because I bet this person even got a thrill out of the fact that he could have been caught at any time. Someone could have looked out their window and seen him. Someone on a bridge could have heard him.
I agree 100%.
I mean, it is just, it's chilling to think how much disregard he has for any sort of normal social fears. Kind of like what I think a serial killer would have in their character.
And I was just about to say that. I think, and I guess, you know, we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves here, but that's fine because we're on a roll. If he has not done this before, he will do it again. And I am surprised that, and I mean, I say I'm surprised. I'm surprised this hasn't happened again. I guess we don't necessarily know that it hasn't happened again. I'm sure the authorities are on the lookout for cases that are similar to this one, because this is not a one-off thing, in my view. This is not, you don't do this once and stop. You just don't do that. That's not what's happening here. I mean, this is either someone who is a serial killer and had done this before, or this was their first murder on the way to being a serial killer.
Right. And so, I've heard a lot of interviews of people, especially Abby and Libby's classmates, who say that they'll never look at these trails again, that they don't go out there by themselves anymore. And usually when people say that about crime scenes, I say that, you know, I think, oh, no, the crime just happened to happen there. Like, it's not that this mall is particularly dangerous. It just, it's very unfortunate that it happened here. But in this case, I think he had hunted those grounds. And I don't think he is bold, might not be the right word, but brash enough to commit this type of murder on those trails anytime soon because of the amount of attention is that is on this case right now. But I don't think it would be the last time if he were given the opportunity to do it on these trails either.
I hate that I am continuously comparing this person to a hunter because I got a lot of friends who are hunters. I have been hunting before myself, but I've never actually seen anything because I'm a terrible hunter. But the best hunters or the best fishermen or whatever, they don't just wander off into the woods one day and decide, well, I'm going to hunt for some deer. They don't just go out in a boat and throw their line out somewhere they've never been before. The guys who really know what they're doing during the off season, they're in the woods. You know, they have trail cameras in those woods. They know better than anybody how many deer are in those woods, where they go, where they're bedding, where they're eating. They know everything about them. And then when hunting season comes, they have a place that they know they can go where the deer are going to walk right by them. They are experts at this. And I just think it never grows old to compare serial killers and these sort of like psychopath sexual killers to hunters, because I really think that's what they are. I think they are people who go out with the intention of hunting and killing other people. And I think most of them know the area very well. If you look at any sort of, you know, you talk to geographical profilers who do this, they can take a profile and they can put the victims, where they were picked up, where the bodies were found. And if they do that with enough victims, they can basically pinpoint where the killer probably lives, because usually it's within sort of a circle around where they live. They don't tend to kill in places they've never been. They don't tend to go off. You would think you would, right? Like there's this thought, you would go off somewhere that's far away from your home and that's where you'd kill people because it makes it hard to find you. That may be true, but you don't know that area. You're not comfortable with that area. You don't feel secure in that area. I think that's what we have here. I think we have somebody who felt safe on those trails. They knew those trails for whatever reason, either because they grew up in Delphi or they lived in Delphi or they lived near Delphi, close enough that they had been there before many times and they felt comfortable there, and they went out there that day thinking, there's going to be my prey out there today. You know, there are going to be kids out there today. On this beautiful day, this snow day, they're going to go out there and I'm going to be ready. That's what I'm seeing. That's what I think happened.
And here's another point, Brett. If he's out there thinking his prey is going to be out there, I think he was prepared for a multi-murder. And I say that because all of our witnesses so far, except for Engels, has been with someone else. And I think it's probably more likely to go hiking with someone than completely alone, especially on a day off from school. You want to hang out with your friends that day, right? So you're probably meeting up with other people to hang out there. You probably only go hiking by yourself if you were wanting to bird watch or take photographs. And then you may not actually want to go on a busy day. If you wanted to be alone, you would probably go on a day when school's not out and you could do whatever you needed to do alone. And so I think that he was prepared for two victims or more.
And Alice, I am so glad you said that. I don't know. We may never have another set of episodes like this because normally we're very sort of organized in how we go through things. But on this one, we're just going about it as it comes to us. But that is something that, you know, I've listened to a lot of podcasts about this and I've read a lot of articles and I've never heard anybody focus on the fact that he went after two people. That is significant to me. That is rare. It is rare to decide you're going to target two people, especially in public. It's one thing if you have like a home invasion murder and you're just whoever's there is who you're killing because you're invading the home, right? Or like a Richard Speck thing where you show up at the dormitory where all the nurses are. I mean, this is out in the open and you decide to target two people. A lot of murderers have what's called a double event, where they will kill two people in one day. But Ordinarily, it's two people in separate incidences. So Jack the Ripper famously has a double event. Ted Bundy famously has a double event. But in both instances, he targets one person, kills that person, and then comes back for another person. In this case, you have someone who attempts to gain control over two different people. Now, I know they're kids. I know they're 13 and 14, but that's not young enough that you would necessarily feel secure in the fact that they'll do whatever you say. We're not talking 6, 7, 8 year olds. We're talking 13 and 14 year olds.
And let's point out, I don't think we've actually talked about this. I don't think it's typically relevant, but in talking about gaining control, I think it's relevant to note that Libby was, I think, about 200 pounds. Is that right? In other words, she was the weight of really an adult. And I'm not sure how much Abby weighed, but I think she was smaller. I think she was probably closer to a kid size, if, you know, if that makes any sense. In other words, I think these are two people who were of substantial size, who had legs that worked and they could run. And Brett, I know we've talked about this when preparing for this case, but the reason you don't go after two victims at one time is because that's two sets of voices you have to keep low. That's two sets of bodies you have to control. And typically, if you don't have a gun, you have to kill them one at a time, right? Even with a gun, you're killing one at a time. And you are typically focused on one victim when you are killing them, and you can't really keep an eye on the other one, and they could get away. And then the most obvious, when you are out in not public, but when you are out in the wild like this, especially as they are going down the hill, they can run opposite directions. What do you do in that direction? Now, I think this murderer knew that was a possibility. I don't know what he did to prevent that from happening. I don't know if he could read, if he was a really good psychologist and could read which of the girls he should take control of and the other one would submit, because for whatever reason, maybe one girl was more of the alpha, and he knew if he gained control of the alpha, then the follower girl would do whatever he said. I don't know. But I think he had to have thought of that before he went after two victims, and he had a plan in mind, or he knew how he was going to handle it, and clearly he executed upon it because he was able to murder both girls.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because either he is a complete moron, right? Like, who just lucked into this and didn't think about anything and it just came together for him. Or, yeah, he really had thought this through and he sort of made a conscious decision. He was going to go after both of them and he thought he could control them both. And he did, for whatever reason. I think it's possible he may have had a gun. People speculate that he had a gun, I think based on sort of this idea of how would he have gained control of them without a gun. I don't actually think he needed a gun. I mean, number one, I think if he had a knife, it was probably enough. And number two, the command in his voice. I just keep going back to this, but I just think the command in his voice was so absolute that when he said those words, guys, down the hill, that they were going to do it. And I think he was confident in that. I think he knew. And this goes back as we're building sort of this ad hoc profile. We're not profilers. We don't work for the FBI. We haven't done any of the training on that. This is just sort of common sense and what we hear and what we see. To me, I think this speaks to someone who was used to getting his way. When he gave a command, it was followed, and he expected that, and he expected that these girls would do what he told them to do, and he didn't need a gun. You've also pointed to something else. You can control two people if you have direct control over one. I mean, just think of any movie where you've got the knife or the gun on one person, and the other person does what you tell them to do. So you could imagine a situation in which he's got physical control of one of them, and it's like, do what I say or your friend's going to get it type thing. I think that's also possible, but it is interesting to me. I just think it says something about this person that he was willing to go through with this with two victims. I think that's significant. So let's go back to the timeline. We'll finish up the timeline. I realize, you know, some of you are like, what happened next? And we keep going off. Anyways, so Bridge Guy, 310 to 315, or someone who looks like Bridge Guy, or someone we speculate is Bridge Guy. Bridge Guy, unconfirmed, passes this couple. It's interesting. The reason the gentleman remembers this is because he was in an argument with his girlfriend at the time. So the girlfriend doesn't remember any of this because she was mad at her boyfriend. So she doesn't remember the guy who walked by. But the 20-year-old, he does. He remembers this person walking by. Now, one thing that's interesting and that's speculated online, and I don't know where this comes from, is that they, along with the girl that we talked about earlier, are the source for the first sketch. We're going to talk about these two sketches later, but the first sketch, which you've seen if you're watching this on YouTube or if you visited our website, and you should because you need to look at these sketches. But the first one is the more detailed one. It shows an older person who, frankly, I think looks more like the individual in the video than maybe the second sketch. In the first sketch, the person is wearing a cap. It looks like a newsboy cap, but it's that sort of short build cap and a sweatshirt. And it's sort of unshaven. These folks were apparently part of the ones who gave that sketch. And the thing that I was saying is not confirmed, and I'm not entirely sure where it came from, is they apparently were unhappy with the sketch at the end. So maybe they didn't think the sketch looked like the person they had seen.
But Brett, if in fact the 16-year-old and then the 20-something witnesses were responsible for the older sketch, I think that tells us something. A 20-year-old and a 16-year-old, or a 20-something and a 16-year-old, are close in age cohort. And if they are describing someone on the older side, I think that says the person they are describing is older than 20-something. And I say that because obviously the second sketch is of someone who could be 20-something. It may just be that when you see someone who looks older than you, you describe them as older, right? And so I don't know if that actually means that person is much older, but I do think it means he's probably older than 20-something. He's probably not a high schooler, based on who they saw.
And let's talk about these sketches. We've kind of talked around them, but I think it's important to talk about them at some point. And we're halfway through the second episode on this, so let's just go ahead and talk about the sketches. There are two sketches, and this is weird. And let me just go ahead and say now, there are going to be times in these episodes where we criticize law enforcement. And I want to say ahead of that, we realize how absurd that is, because these guys are on the scene. You know, they are in the arena. Some of you know about the famous "the man in the arena" speech from Teddy Roosevelt. It's one of the best speeches about how stupid it is to criticize somebody who's in the middle of the fight when you're sitting on the sidelines. And these guys are in the middle of the fight, and they're given, you know, 20 hours a day on this. And I hate to criticize them, and so everybody take any criticism we make with a grain of salt. But there are two sketches in this case. The first one was released. It wasn't immediately released. That's the weird thing about this. They released a sketch later on. It is a sketch of, as I described earlier, of what looks like an older, slightly overweight individual with a short brimmed cap, wearing a sweatshirt, sort of unshaven, some sort of unkempt hair. And frankly, and we've got side by sides of the sketch and the image of Bridge Guy. To me, when I look at these two photos, the first one, to me, looks more like the image of Bridge Guy. Now, once again, the image is not great, but to me, it's the one that looks most like Bridge Guy. And that was the sketch that we had for 2 years. And that was who people were looking for. And they were doing side-by-sides with people on Facebook and ruining people's lives and showing up at their houses and getting them fired and like all sorts of other crazy stuff because they kind of looked like the sketch. Then, in April of 2019, the police released a new sketch, a sketch that they had back in 2017. And it, to me, could not look more different. Where the first sketch appears to show 30s or 40s year old guy, maybe even older than that, the second sketch looks like, you know, he's playing quarterback at your high school. Right? I mean, a young guy with sort of, I don't even know how to describe this, but like young guy hair. You know, you're probably looking at this right now on YouTube if you're watching this.
curly crop like hair, whereas the other guy had more scruffy hair.
Exactly, like more put together, no facial hair, no sort of unkemptness, no unshavenness. I mean, to me, he looks like he's what, Alice, between 17 and 25?
Yeah, maybe younger than 25. I like 17 to 21, almost.
Right. So we have these two very, very different sketches. When the second sketch is released, the police say, and both sketches are supposedly of Bridge Guy, the police say that that is now the primary sketch and the other sketch is secondary. When I heard that, my thoughts and just immediately went to two people, accomplices who are doing this together. Two people, two girls. That apparently is not what the police think. When they said primary, what they mean is this sketch is more likely what the person looks like. But don't discard the other sketch. And maybe in reality, if you can somehow combine the two sketches in your mind, that is what the person would look like.
You're right. The first time I knew there were two sketches, I immediately thought, oh, two people. But the reason we know that the cops think that they are the same person is because they have said likely the person is somewhere in between these two. And they have not said these are two suspects.
Yeah. And talking to Kelsey, she seemed to indicate that part of this may just be the people who saw this guy and how different people view people differently. If you're younger, you see somebody who's in their 20s and maybe you think they're in their 30s or their 40s or whatever, just because your perspective is different. And I think the idea is you have the 16-year-old and you have the 20-year-old and they see this person and they give you a sketch of what looks like an older guy and it's they're aging the person who's actually younger. I just don't know about that because
they're so vastly different though, Brett.
They're so different.
And we're talking about maybe just a 20-year difference, right? Let's say maybe it's a 20-year-old sketch and then like maybe a 40-year-old. So we're not talking about like a 15-year-old and an 85-year-old. And one thing I want to note, Brett, is in the witnesses we do know about, they note that they couldn't see the lower half of the face. And the whole picture is just completely different. But note how different the lower halves of the faces are. The shape of the jaw, the shape of the nose, facial hair. I just wonder how accurate either of these photos are if the witnesses couldn't see the lower half of the face and their minds probably just filled in what they thought should match someone who, as the 16-year-old said, gave her the creeps. So the first picture is someone who gives me the creeps. The second picture, the younger guy, doesn't necessarily give me the creeps because, like you said, he looks like he probably plays some sport. He has a really thick neck. Again, how would you know he has a thick neck, like as if he lifted weights, if it were under a hoodie and a jacket and a scarf?
Yeah, the second guy looks like somebody I'd hire to cut my grass. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. That's a really good point, though, because I was going to just say how different their jawline and their chin is, and I hadn't thought about that. That really, of all the parts of their face, those are the ones nobody saw. So it probably is. There's a reason that they look so different there. I'll say this. The eyes are similar. You know, I think there's a similar look in the eyes. The hair, I don't really get. Because if he was wearing a hat, I don't understand the hair thing. I don't know. I don't understand this second drawing.
And I guess if that is in fact the hair described by the witnesses, are they saying that there wasn't a hat or a hoodie at all? And if so, how would they know what the hair was like? Because what I see in this picture is like pretty tight curls, almost like what's that actor's name? Ben Savage, Corey Matthews on Boy Meets World. That's kind of what the hair looks like, right? It's very curly, and that's why it doesn't look styled. It looks like that is the shape of the hair.
I'll say this about the Bridge Guy photo. If you look at the Bridge Guy photo and you imagine that what's on his head is not a hat, but that's actually his hair. And if you haven't looked at this photo, you're thinking, how could you mistake that? Trust me, you can. But if you look at it and you see hair, just make yourself see hair on this guy, he suddenly looks much younger. That's the one thing I'll say about it. If you can look at him and see hair, he looks younger to me.
I agree with that, but I'll also note, when I try to make myself see hair, because I see a hat, when I try to make myself see hair on that still photo, it looks like a toupee and it looks fake. It looks like a joke, almost like if he were acting, which makes me think it was actually a hat. Because it just looks out of place somehow, the way it comes over his brow line. Usually people's hair don't come down that low, unless you have, I guess, like a Bieber sweep. But the second sketch doesn't indicate bangs.
Okay. So you all should take a look at these sketches. All of this is on the website. If you're watching on YouTube, you've seen it all before anyway. Would be very interested to hear what you see. And here's the thing about sketches. Here's the thing about video. They're really not designed for just a random person to see them and then see the person later on. I mean, that's really not how they typically work. It happens sometimes. I always think that's crazy. There is no way. I could see Bridge Guy tomorrow and would not recognize him. I'm always amazed by people. Like, we talked about the Lois Race case where she's at a bar in Texas and somebody sees her photo. I mean, it's a photo, but still, somebody sees her photo on television and realizes that person is at the bar and calls the police. I think they could literally be sitting under the television with their picture above them, and I would not put two and two together. I just don't think I would. So I'm always amazed when people do that.
I'm with you there. I know we only have a second and a half of a video, and all we really see is him take maybe two steps, but his hands are in his pockets. Brett, you and I do a lot of witness interactions. We prep witnesses, we interview witnesses, we read body language, we read the unspoken a lot to see whether people are lying to us, how confident they are, how at ease they are in front of law enforcement, which I understand is difficult because if I were being interviewed by the cops, even though I know I've done nothing wrong, I could still be nervous. But we are constantly doing that in our jobs. And the ease that this guy moves with, to me, comes with age. He does not move like someone who is a teenager to me. The kind of nonchalant hands in the pockets and the ease with which he's moving. And I say this because I have taken witnesses who are not even teenagers, young 20s. And there is just this, everyone's different, but there is this level of hesitancy because they recognize in big situations where they're being called to testify in a court of law under oath, that they haven't lived as much life as other people. And no matter how confident my witness is, if they are on the younger side, I usually build in extra time in talking them through the process because almost always men, women, confident, not confident, doesn't really matter. They need more coaching to be comfortable in big moments. This is a big moment for Bridge Guy. He is confident. That I can see.
No, and I think you're right. I mean, it is a second and a half, and we showed it in the last episode, and we may show it in this episode because you can't see it enough, but he does. He just looks so confident. I'm actually watching it right now. As you said that, I pulled it up on my computer, and he just looks so confident in his... completely nonchalant, hands in the pocket, walking across the bridge, no big deal. Yeah, and that makes you wonder, and I hate to keep going back to it, but it makes you wonder if he's done this before. It just makes you wonder. This is a big deal.
It is a big deal. The girls don't yet know it's a big deal, but he does, right? He is moving, and he knows what's coming next. This is kind of a callback to what you talked about previously, Brett. You said that he chose the location. One other note about this location is he knew he had to cross a bridge where he couldn't maintain eye contact or visual on the girls because he knew he needed to look down at the bridge in order to cross it, no matter how familiar he was with that bridge. That, again, is so bold. He doesn't need his eye on the prize.
Right. And I think you're 100% right about that. That's why he's looking down. I don't think he knew they were filming him. You know, I don't I don't think he knew that was happening. Number one, Libby was very surreptitious about it. That's why we only have 1.5 seconds. She was 65 feet away when it happened. We don't know whether he tried to destroy the cell phone. The police haven't told us. We know the police have the cell phone. We don't know where they found it or anything like that. But it seems like he doesn't know. So he's not looking down to hide his face. He's looking down to maneuver across the bridge. And so, like Alice said, he's just as confident as he could be. He's not nervous about this. He's not thinking, I got to watch these girls every second or they might get away. There's nothing about him that's nervous in this circumstance. And you can hear it in his voice when he gets there. I can't even imagine. I try not to imagine what I would feel like if I was about to kill someone, but just imagine any high stress situation you've ever been in. Imagine, you know, you're giving a big presentation at work, or you've got a speech to make, or you're doing something that's really important. You're quarterback on your high school team, or you're the kicker, or you're playing tennis in the championship, or whatever it is that is a big moment for you, a stressful moment. Think about how nervous you were. Think about how many times you had to go in the bathroom and sort of look yourself in the eyes and say, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. You're going to do this. You know, I mean, to this day, when I do oral arguments in front of like a big panel of judges, I am incredibly nervous until it starts. When it starts, I'm fine. But before it starts, I'm incredibly nervous. Going to the bathroom, I'm like psyching myself up or whatever. This guy, this is his big moment. I mean, that may sound weird to you, but it's true. This is his big moment. There's no telling how long he's been looking forward to this, how long he's been working towards this moment, and it's here. And yet, he is so calm, and he is so in command, and he's not nervous. It's just, there is, someone knows this person. This is not something a normal person can do. I hate to keep harping on it.
Don't focus on these pictures. No. I think, you know, the reason we are going, we've made it through two paragraphs of our notes. And the reason we spent so much time on describing to you what we think is the profile of this person is because I don't think you should be looking at the pictures, the sketches. I think you need to be thinking about someone who fits the personality that we're describing.
No, I think that's 100% right. That's 100% right. And maybe the sketch is a connection, or the picture is a connection, or the way he walks is a connection. But we are looking for a personality here. We are looking for someone who could do this, who has that personality. That's what you need to be thinking about. I think Alice is 100% right on this. 100% right. So as we keep talking about it, I hope you keep that in mind, that really is what we're trying to find here. And I'll keep going through the timeline because I know, like I said, some of y'all are wondering what happens next. So we're at 3:10 and 3:15. And I'm sorry. I mean, the fact of the matter is most people have heard this case before. So for those of you out there who this is your first time, I am sorry that we're kind of assuming knowledge. We don't normally do that, but we're doing that in this case, and bear with us.
Hey, Brett, I do want you to clarify one thing. A couple times throughout the timeline, you have mentioned that a particular fact is unconfirmed. What do you mean by that? Do you mean it's unconfirmed by the police or are you saying that it's unconfirmed by the actual witness that it's supposed to come from?
Sort of both. Either the police have never told us this, or the person involved has never said anything. So, for instance, Cheyenne Ingalls has been very forthcoming about the fact that she was on the trail that day. She took a picture. She's posted the picture that she took. You can find it online very easily. The police have never confirmed that. They've never said, yes, Cheyenne Ingalls was on the bridge that day. But there's enough information out there, I think you can say that's confirmed. Similarly, when Kelsey says, I dropped the girls off, the police may or may not have confirmed that. I'm not sure, but that's confirmed. As far as we're concerned, and I think as far as anybody's concerned, we're also going to talk about some stuff from Libby's father. We consider that confirmed. The big things that we've mentioned that have not been confirmed are the witness statements, which is not surprising that those things haven't necessarily been confirmed by the police, because the police have kept a lot close to the vest in this case, and that's one of the things.
And Brett, I only I only ask you to clarify that because, as our listeners know, we typically pride ourselves in only putting evidence out there. And so we want you to know that even though these are unconfirmed facts, there is enough behind them that we have included them here. We think they are just unconfirmed in the sense that the police hasn't said, hey, public, this is what happened. But we don't think it's just some conspiracy theory on a Reddit thread. There are a lot of those that we have left out of here because we do not think there's enough basis to include them. So we have chosen to include these unconfirmed facts because we do think they are very dependable facts.
Right. And the reason we've noted that they're unconfirmed, and we'll continue to do that, is we just want to be upfront with you guys. And to the extent we're relying on stuff that maybe we typically wouldn't rely on, we want you to know that. So we just, like I said, I hate to be critical of the police, but I think at the end of the day, if we find this guy, this case is solved. Because I think there's probably enough evidence at the site where if we find the guy who did it, they'll be able to tie him to this crime. So if there are things that might jog somebody's memory, we're going to err on the side of just telling you and hoping that it jogs your memory, with sort of the caveat that we will note that the police have not said, yeah, that's what happened. So, okay. Around 3:11, Libby's father, Derek, calls Libby's phone. He's on his way to pick him up. It's time to pick them up. He said he would pick him up between 3 and 3:30. He calls at 3:11. It goes straight to voicemail. At 3:15, Derek has arrived at the pickup location. The girls are not there. He gets out and he starts to walk the trails. He speaks with a man named Dave McCain, who says he hasn't seen the girls. Dave does mention a couple by the bridge. We do not know this for certain, but that may very well be the couple who was arguing, who says they saw a bridge guy or someone who might have been bridge guy walking towards the Freedom Bridge. Okay, so at this point, people are starting to get concerned. The family starts calling each other. There's a search party organized. People head out to the trails and they're looking for the girls. By 4:30 that day, Kelsey is now at the south end of High Bridge and she goes down the hill. And she sees what she describes as sort of disrupted ground, indicating that someone had recently gone down the hill and perhaps even slipped down the hill. At this point, law enforcement is there in earnest and they are searching for the girls. The search is called off around 11:45 p.m., which becomes controversial. It's not really controversial to me, but that is when they call off the search that night.
You know, it's chilling about the timeline of Derek German proceeding to the trails. Very possibly Bridge Guy could have seen Derek or known he was there, just based on the couple who had seen Bridge Guy around 3:10 or 3:15. And I think he was probably looking to get out, so he probably didn't stay around, but I think he very well could have overheard Derek asking if anyone had seen Abby and Libby.
Let's say that Abby and Libby were killed at 2:45. And let's say that Bridge Guy is parked, because I assume he had a car, somewhere near the Freedom Bridge. That's where the 16-year-old saw him earlier. He's headed in that direction when the couple sees him. If that's the case, it's going to take him at least 30 minutes to get to the Freedom Bridge, which means if they didn't cross paths, they probably came pretty close. I think it is absolutely possible, if not likely, that Bridge Guy was on the trail when Derek arrived. Whether they crossed paths, it's hard to say. But yeah, I mean, that's, and once again, that's how tight this timeline is, that it's not even clear that Bridge Guy was gone by the time people were searching for Abby and Libby.
And that goes again to his frame of mind when he thought about committing this crime. Remember how long Abby and Libby planned to be out on the trail? Hour and a half? They, you know, not long, right? This was not a long hike, even from bridge to bridge, 30 minutes. This is not one of those trails that takes 4 or 5 hours to walk. And so he knew that young girls who can't drive would have a ride coming. someone would discover that they were missing very close in time to when he committed the murders. And he still did it. Again, that goes to his boldness, and it goes to, I bet, the thrill he has in potentially being seen, being discovered, and being discovered quickly.
I mean, depending on whether or not he was watching when they were dropped off, for all he knew, their parents or their guardians or their group was on the trails, and they had just, you know, taken a left when everybody else went right with the intention of meeting up with them in a few minutes. I mean, it is an incredibly bold thing he did, and I just go back to how calm he was. It's one thing to be secure, you know, if you're a murderer in a dark alley at 3 o'clock in the morning and you feel pretty secure in the fact that it's you and your victim. It is another thing altogether to be as calm and bold as he was in the middle of the day in a busy public area where anybody could see you. I mean, it's something else. It really is. It is a striking thing about him. February 14th, 7:40 is when sunrise happens, but the search is actually delayed due to thick fog. The search resumes around 9 a.m. At this point, we have canine teams brought in. So around noon is when the bodies of the two girls are discovered. It's actually on private property that's adjacent to the park. It's the Logan property. The bodies were found after a shoe was located. So Kelsey was actually out there searching for the girls. She had been on the bridge. And, you know, look, and this goes to how close everything is and how, and going back to whether or not somebody would have heard the girls. Kelsey is literally just off the bridge when a searcher calls up and says that they found a shoe. And it's a shoe that Kelsey immediately recognizes as one that Libby was wearing. And immediately after this is when they find the bodies of the girls. And I want to read to you what a user on Reddit said about this. Now, look, I have no idea if this is accurate, but there was something that I found striking and potentially even beautiful about this description. So I just wanted to read it to you. At that point, one member of the party where the shoe had been found saw two deer. He used his phone to zoom in on the deer and shifted his view angle downward from the deer and saw the bodies. So that's how the bodies were discovered, at least according to this user from Reddit. So once again, they find the shoe, they find the bodies, and they are close enough that when someone calls up about the shoe, Kelsey, who's near the bridge, can hear them.
And Brett, I think this goes to our question earlier, whether Engel standing on the bridge would have been able to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the answer to that is almost certainly yes. If something was going on when she was standing on that bridge at 3, if this were not done by then, she would have heard something. If the girls were crying out for help, she would have heard. Well, I think that's all we're going to do for today. We're going to go ahead and do one more episode on this case. I think it's absolutely worthy of a third episode. And like I said on the first episode, the more time we can spend on this and the more time all of you can spend thinking about this, the better. It is not a waste at all. And we want to do that. So we're going to do one more on this. We finish with the timeline, essentially. We're going to talk more about sort of all these different aspects that we've touched on but really haven't dived into yet. We'll talk some more about theories. We'll talk some more about some of the unusual things about this case. And like I said, hopefully the more we talk about it, the more likely somebody out there is going to hear something and it's going to trigger a thought in your mind, a memory in your mind, and you will be the tip that will turn this case around. We're two episodes in. At this point, we've almost certainly said something that is incorrect. I hope you guys will let us know, and we will make sure to correct that. Our email address is prosecutorspod@gmail.com. For Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, it's @prosecutorspod. We're also on Reddit. We're on YouTube. And we are now on Patreon. So if you would like to support us, We are always happy to have your support. Thank you to everybody who has done that. You guys are amazing. As we've said before, if you are supporting us on Patreon and there's a case you want to hear about, let us know. We're going to move you guys to the top of the list. This was a case that overwhelmingly people on Patreon and off of Patreon wanted to hear about. So we were happy to do it. Well, Alice, do you have any other thoughts before we wrap this one up today?
No, but thank you guys for coming on this journey with us, and we look forward to you coming back next time.
Yeah, I know, like I said, this is probably not as happy-go-lucky, enjoyable as some of our other cases, but I think of all the things we've done, of all the cases we've done up to this point, this is the one that matters the most. And this is the one that if we could make a difference, man, I hope. Frankly, I don't even care if it's us. I just hope somebody makes a difference, because this is a case that we need to see solved. We will be back next week with more on Delphi. We'll wrap it up then, most likely. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors.
Now we're just like pat each other on the back. But what I really like about our episodes is when I'm listening to them, like as a listener, I try to put myself in the listener's shoes when it comes out. I will have questions in my head and I'm like, oh, we should have talked about that. And I think we didn't talk about it. Like, this is a natural conclusion we would reach from that. And then I'm like, oh, it's too bad. That was a missed opportunity. And then we'll talk about it later. I'm like, oh, way to go,
so
guys.
So brilliant.
You didn't leave
so
it
out. Good. So good.
So
good.
About it as if it were another case, because I honestly didn't know all the drama around
right.
it. And so I was like, oh, it's a super interesting case, but it wasn't like, hey, so you're going to rewrite and reinterpret the Odyssey.
Okay.